Well, good morning, everyone. It's delightful to be back here. Some of you were here yesterday. We did a full day workshop on some of the more detailed nuances of Vipassana meditation and Buddhist psychology and so forth. I thought today I would lighten up a little bit and address an issue that's a little more broad and hopefully of more wide interest to all of us as householders and people who live in the secular world. I was asked by Gil, I asked him when he invited me to come this morning what he wants me to talk on, and he said, well, something on nature poetry would be nice. So I'm going to address the issue of nature poetry, but not directly. Because the first thing we have to sort of come to grips with in the early Buddhist tradition is how could there be a place in the Buddha's way of looking at things for the aesthetic appreciation of nature? And I think if we can answer this theoretical question first, then it will allow us, it'll give us a little more permission to savor the textures of this quite lovely poetry that we find in ancient India on the subject. We're perhaps more familiar with nature poetry in the East Asian traditions. It seems very much wound up in the very fabric of Japanese culture, Chinese Buddhism, and all those northern and northeastern traditions where we hear many, many inspired poets working in those languages that seem to draw on and be inspired by many Buddhist themes. But it's not as well known that there is some very good nature poetry in the early Indian tradition. In medieval Sanskrit poetics, there's very elaborate allusions to nature. But even in the Pali Canon, even in that body of literature that's regarded by so many as being sort of dry and technical, and it's even been called world-denying, there is quite lovely stuff. And I'm going to share just a little of that with you today. But how could that be? Because one of the things that seems to come through a lot in the Buddhist teaching is a great deal of concern about our engagement with pleasure and how that pleasure will invariably lead to desire and how that desire will inevitably cause suffering. So if it's the case that in some particular way pleasure is the cause ultimately of suffering, then why would we be encouraged, or why would advanced disciples of the Buddha spend time leaving us stanzas that appreciate aesthetically the beauties of nature? Is there some contradiction going on here? One of the things that really makes nature poetry beautiful and so well inspired in East Asian tradition is an appreciation of impermanence. There's a way in which the Buddhist emphasis upon the ever-changing nature of reality coincided nicely with the Chinese and Japanese views on nature as an ever-changing unfolding of phenomena. And it was even especially in Japan the case that the very transience itself of beauty, of a flower, of a rainbow, of something, the very fact that it was so fragile rendered it all the more beautiful. And in East Asian poetics, it often seems the more fleeting, the more fragile something is, the more beautiful it becomes. Now, as we know, the Buddha was teaching that impermanence is actually a source of suffering. In South Asian tradition, the Indian traditions that the Buddha grew up in, there wasn't that appreciation for the changeability of the natural forces. In fact, in one of his original discourses, in the very first discourse he gave, in the catechism that comes up again and again throughout the Buddhist texts, O monks, is such and such impermanent or permanent? The answer is it's permanent. It's impermanent. Well, because it's impermanent then, O monks, is it something that is a source of happiness or of suffering? And the answer has to come. It's suffering. The very impermanence of everything around us itself is a source of suffering. It gets a little worse in the Second Noble Truth, where it's defined that the cause of suffering is desire. But then when that desire is defined, in again, a very common phrase that repeats itself throughout the canon, it's defined as that craving that is associated with delight and passion. Nandi raga sahagata. Gone together with nandi, which is a word for delighting in something, taking joy, and raga, which is a much stronger word for the kind of addiction that we can have, the desire that is burning and causing us to really misbehave in some very unskillful ways. But there's that word delight, right in the very definition of the Second Noble Truth. And it goes on in that phrase to talk about one of the ways craving is manifest is in delighting in this and that. Tatra tatra nandani. Delighting in this, delighting in that. And surely that's what we do when we go through a walk in the woods. We're delighting in this scent and that vista and this flower and that animal and so forth. So what's up here? Are we doing something wrong or what? I don't think so. I think there's a way to construe what's happening in a different way that involves looking a little bit more closely at the details of Buddhist psychology. In the relationship between pleasure and desire and grasping and suffering. As many of you know, the teaching of dependent origination is a way of describing in some detail how the human psychophysical organism, the mind and body, gets caught moment after moment after moment in suffering. And in that model, they're describing how pleasure and pain, both, but we'll emphasize pleasure today, is something that is hardwired to our psychophysical apparatus. I mean, we have senses, and those senses bring in information, and they construct meaning, they construct a self-identity, a sense of the world, and construct experience moment after moment after moment. One of the elements of that experience that's constructed is a feeling tone of pleasure or pain. Liking something, not liking something. Having something feel good or not feel good. And, of course, a great deal of neutral feeling, a feeling tone that doesn't easily resolve itself into pleasant or unpleasant, but nevertheless runs like a thread through our stream of consciousness. Now, the teachings on interdependent origination go on to say that that pleasure that comes with every moment's experience, that pleasure or pain, that feeling tone, becomes the primary condition, the primary cause of desire, of craving. Why? Because like all the other animals in the world, we are conditioned by the pleasure-pain reflex. When something feels good, we are designed to seek more of it. That's how we were taught back in primordial soup to hunt food, you know? And when we experience pain, we are designed to avoid it, to deny it, to resist it, to overcome it somehow. Again, because we're trained by, you know, eons of natural selection to get out of danger, to escape those situations that cause us harm. So right there, it seems like a very, very deep conditioning in us that when we experience pleasure, we want more of it. And that's where we start getting into the causes of suffering in the Buddhist way of looking at things. Because it's that desire, it's that wanting a little bit more that's causing our suffering. It's not the pleasure. Pleasure is not the cause of suffering. Desire is the cause of suffering. But pleasure is the condition for the emergence of desire. And that's why for so many of us, so much of the time, it's an automatic sweep. Something feels good, we want more of it. Something feels bad, we want to get out of the way. And the trouble is when we have this desire, this sort of motivating force of wanting things to be different than they are, the pleasure is going away, I want that to change, I want to get it back. Or the pain is coming, I want that to change, I want it to go away. Then that desire is motivating a whole series of actions that in the Buddhist terminology is called clinging or grasping. And that's where we evoke and enact and play out all sorts of latent tendencies in us towards greediness and hatefulness and delusion. The three unwholesome roots are switched on by our desire. And so when we act in the world, whether we're acting physically or verbally or even thinking mental thoughts, those actions are unskillful. They're unwholesome. They lead us into more and more suffering. And that's where all the trouble begins. So what must be happening when we have these arhats, these fully awakened beings, whose awakening is equal to that of the Buddha, commenting on the beauty of nature? What must be happening is that they are experiencing pleasure without experiencing desire. And that, I think, is what allows for aesthetics, even in the earliest phases of Buddhism. So how do we go about doing that? I mean, again, in the models of dependent origination, all the things before this division between pleasure and desire, all the things, contact and sense spheres and consciousness and mind and body and intentions, all those things are natural to all functioning human beings, even the Buddha. Even an arhat has the five aggregates. He has a body, she has a body, and there's the mental factors of feeling and perception and consciousness and intention. That's not the problem. The problem begins with the transition from feeling to desire. And that desire is the first manifestation of something pathological, something harmful. It begins to get toxic. The human mind, body, and organism gets toxic when it wants things to be different than they are. The tool that we have been given to sort of play that edge in a skillful way, rather than get swept over that edge by our deep conditioning as organisms, the tool we've been given is mindfulness. The ability to notice with great accuracy and great clarity exactly what is arising as it is, without us adding to it, without us projecting our wishes, our longing onto it. When we are experiencing any object of perception in a mindful way, we are expressing equanimity. Equanimity is what you get when you're not attracted towards something likable and you're not repelled from something unlikable. Equanimity is a balanced state of mind that is strong enough to absorb the pleasure without getting pulled into the pleasure. That doesn't allow the pleasure to pull you into craving. Equanimity is brought about by mindfulness, because mindfulness is dropping below the level of our conceptual construction of reality into the raw stream of phenomena that are coming at us through our senses moment after moment. When we're able to just be with what is actually arising, rather than sort of laying our hopes and wishes and so forth on it, a process which, of course, is largely driven by misunderstanding, then we begin to see things as they are without the leaning into them and wanting them to be different or wanting them to continue, wanting them to not change when the very nature of things is to change all the time. It's especially hard for us in this country. I think I forget if it's the Constitution or the Declaration of Independence, but this country is devoted to the pursuit of happiness. And I think the Buddhists are saying, there's nothing wrong with happiness. We all want it. The problem comes from pursuing it. Happiness is not something that can be stalked and pounced upon and appropriated and taken home and put in a cage and looked at whenever we want it. That's that tendency of us to go out beyond the moment into something else. I think what the Buddhists would allow for and approve of, and what many of these early poets are expressing, is an acquiescence to happiness, an acquiescence to pleasure. Pleasure and pain, after all, are the twin modalities of our feeling strand, of the aggregate of feeling. Pleasure and pain are always going to be coming up. The Buddha experienced pleasure. He clearly experienced pain before his passing away. The difference between him and us, perhaps, is that we can't help but like the pleasure. You're allowed to have pleasure. You're not allowed to like it. And it's a nuance. But the liking is when the desire starts, you know? The wanting, the liking and the wanting go together. The just appreciating or observing of something pleasurable is okay, because you can do that with equanimity. So the question is, can we go for that walk in the woods or somehow place ourselves in a situation where pleasure will inevitably arise and just manage to be with it with equanimity, with mindfulness, rather than with liking and wanting and delighting in? When you delight in something, you lose yourself in it. You identify with it. When you're mindful of something, you retain your independence, in the sense of not relying upon that object, and you are able to, I won't say savor it, but at least to appreciate it. And I think what we're seeing in the early Buddhist nature poetry is an appreciation of nature. This tradition was not world-denying. It wasn't going around saying nature is ugly and terrible. That's going to the other extreme of aversion, of resistance, of ill will towards the world. I think that's exactly what the Buddha was rejecting when he settled upon the middle way approach. The ascetics of his time, the people who, you know, really took on austerities and tried to shut out the world and make anything beautiful into a source of pain, there was a lot of that going on in ancient India, and there still is in modern India, and some of it rather extreme. I think the Buddha was saying that is an unbalanced way of doing things. But it's equally, of course, unbalanced to be living in the palace surrounded by, you know, sensual pleasures and designing one's life around the pursuit of those pleasures, the recreation of those pleasures moment after moment, day after day, because that will inevitably lead to disappointment simply because it's unsustainable. If we acquiesce to appreciating pleasure when it comes our way, but then also, and here's the kicker, equally acquiesce to pain or displeasure when it comes, and hold both with equal equanimity, then I think we are fulfilling the Buddha's way of training. We are having experience that is pleasurable or painful, without it throwing us off balance, without us needing it to be other than it is. And I think the suffering he speaks about is caused by the needing, the neediness that's built into our psychophysical organism. And I think that's what he was trying to train us or point away out of, train us away from. Be human, be fully embodied human being, accepting pleasure and pain, But don't be driven by it. Don't be addicted to it. Don't lose your freedom, your independence, by getting absorbed into identifying with the things that cause you pleasure and pain. So let me just read you a couple of poems to show sort of how I see this working out in the literature. These are just fragments to begin with, and then I'll read a longer one. There's one here in the Terigata by a monk named Abhaya, means fearless. And it translates as this: seeing a form, that is with the eye, mindfulness becomes confused. For one who pays attention to a charming object, he experiences it with an impassioned mind and stays clinging to it. His toxins increase, which lead further on to samsara. Now, that's not meant to be nature poetry, but that's a description of the psychological dynamic of which I'm speaking. Mindfulness is the ability to hold equanimity in any given situation. When one, this monk now is talking about seeing something alluring, something delightful, and so forth, then it breaks up that mindfulness. It disturbs it. It confuses it. The mindfulness dissipates as one loses that objective, observing, equanimous stance and gets drawn into the allure, the liking of something. Then when you pay attention to the charming aspect of that thing, look at that beautiful flower, look at the red in it and so forth, you can get lost in that, and that's what's going to dissipate your mindfulness. He experiences it with an impassioned mind. At that moment, the mind which had been in equanimity, dispassionate, that doesn't mean detached, it just means evenly balanced, not under the enchantment of the passions. In that moment of attending to what is so charming about that object, one is conjuring up the desire, conjuring up the latent tendency to be drawn into enjoyment of something. And so with that impassioned mind now, that is the mind that is infused with desire, then one is clinging to it. And remember, the teachings on Vipassana meditation end all in the main discourse on this, every other paragraph with the phrase, a person dwells independent, not clinging to anything in the world. Mindfulness is a tool for us to disengage, to become unattached from our experience. That doesn't mean, you know, unconnected, as we use the word these days, but it means not lost in or identified in. That little gap is what mindfulness gives us. And we lose that space wherein lies our freedom to choose how we respond to it. We lose that when we get lost in the object, when the desire bubbles up. And then the clinging takes over. It's a lovely phrase in Pali, by the way. Having seen a form, mindfulness gets confused. In Pali, it's rupam diswa sati mutta. Here's a poem by Radha, or just a phrase. Just as rain does not penetrate a well-thatched hut, so desire does not penetrate a well-developed mind. The sense of mindfulness and composure and equanimity being a bastion of strength, of substance, of profundity. You're holding yourself in the world with power, with independence, with confidence. And you can experience pleasure and pain in that state without difficulty, without confusion. Desire, kind of like the rain coming down, just breaks its waves off of that. But then when the confidence dissipates a little bit, desire, like water, sneaks in, seeps in, and then it throws things off balance. Here's a monk, Chittaka, says, the call of the crested blue-necked peacocks in the Karamvia forest, urged on by the cool breeze, awakens the sleeper to meditation. In this case, the alluring sound and the beauty and so forth isn't the antithesis of meditation. Meditation is not closing yourself in the hut so you don't see that. The sound of that itself can become an object of mindfulness as long as it's regarded with equanimity. Here's a monk, Deva Subha, says, he will become fully enlightened without toxins while ranging in the foundations of mindfulness and while covered with the flowers of liberation. There he's using nature imagery to define the very qualities of mindfulness and liberation that the Dhamma is steering us towards. Another way of using nature imagery in both psychological ways, Mahakotaka is able to, quote, shake off unwholesome thoughts as the wind shakes off leaves of a tree. His unwholesome thoughts are the things that are inviting desire and clinging into one's experience. For Ramanayaka, another monk, amidst the sounds of chirping and the cries of birds, this mind of mine does not waver, for devotion to solitude is mine. Now here he seems to have the image. This devotion to solitude doesn't necessarily mean living alone in the woods, although it probably did. It's solitude in the larger sense of what I've been describing is not being in dependence upon certain gratification from the senses. This holding oneself independent. So the sound of chirping and the cries of birds, all of which are beautiful, and he's clearly acknowledging the beauty of those sounds. The mind does not waver. That doesn't mean it's shutting out the pleasant sensations. That simply means that in the midst of having the pleasant sensations, the mind is not destabilized by that pleasure and tipping over into desire for it. So the birds can stop chirping, and that would be fine too. Or some really ugly sound, I can't think of one in the forest, but some unpleasant auditory sensation could arise in the ear door, and that would be okay. It's not about not having experience. It's about having experience in a way that you maintain your freedom. Maintain your freedom. You don't get pulled off. You don't get jerked around by the world, as I'd like to put it. So I want to read you a longer poem that kind of summarizes this a little bit. This is a poem by Mahakasapa. Mahakasapa, as many of you will know, is one of the foremost of the Buddhist disciples. He left us a long poem in the Theragata, the collection of poetry by the monks and nuns. And he uses a word in this. There are 8 stanzas I'm going to read you. And 11 times in these 8 stanzas, he uses this one word, which is translated throughout by lovely or pleasing and so forth. Now, there's this phrase, I should say, that one of the ways that early Buddhist poetry can be constructed is with a recurring chorus. There are 4 stanzas, there are 4 lines to a stanza. The 4th line repeats itself over the course of the poem. And the phrase that repeats itself here is te se la ramayatimam. Te se la ramayatimam. Te means those. Se la is rocks or mountains or hills. Mum is me. Ramayati is the key verb here, which means to be pleasing, to be enjoyable. I translate that here as these rocky crags do please me so, because I'm trying to fit the meter. This is all working on 8 syllables per line, and I try to translate the English in 8 syllables per line as well. So this word pleasing, though, I want to look at just a little bit, because in other translations of this particular poem by very good scholars such as K.R. Norman, he uses the word delight. He says these rocky crags or these mountains delight me. And that bothered me. That worried me, Because if delight is found in the very definition of craving as the cause of suffering in the Second Noble Truth, and then the same word is used by an obvious arhat in his maturity of his wisdom, and if we, if the same word is used, then we've got a problem, because it suggests that the arhat may actually be causing suffering. When you go to the Pali, you find out that the word translated as delight in the cause of suffering is nandi, and the word used for delight in this case is ramayati, or ramma, ramana. And it's a very different word. And I think that distinction between the words needs to be brought out, which is why I'm introducing this concept of being pleased by something. And I think that that word is used throughout here. When he says that something is lovely or beautiful, he's saying that it's pleasing to him. That means that in the field of phenomena, he's sitting there in the forest, and these things are happening, these sounds and these sights and so forth. They are the objects dependent upon which the experience of pleasure is arising. End of story. Accurate description of what's happening. But because he's an arhat, the unwholesome roots of greed, hatred, and delusion are pulled up for good. And so the mechanism by which that pleasure would pull him into craving or desire is completely stopped, completely transformed. So I think the arhats in particular are well able to appreciate beauty around them, and I might add, to endure pain around them indiscriminately in ways that we have to be a little bit more careful of, I think. And one last thing, just to put this into context. This is just 8 stanzas pulled out of a much longer poem. The very stanza before the one I'm going to read first describes Mahakasapa begging from town to town with his bowl, and somebody puts food into his bowl, and that person happens to be a leper, and the person's finger falls off and falls into his bowl. And the stanza goes on to say that he ate his breakfast without any discrimination about that being the case. It doesn't clarify whether that means he ate the finger or not. I don't necessarily think so. But the point is, and that's juxtaposed just before this beautiful nature poetry I'm about to read you. And I think that's making the case that whether it's something that we would say, ew, that's foul, or whether it's something we would say, oh, that's wonderful, he can hold both of them equally. Not a big deal, because that mechanism that pulls him into desire is gone. So here's the poem. Strung with garlands of flowering vines, this patch of earth delights the mind. The lovely calls of elephants sound, these rocky crags do please me so. The shimmering hue of darkening clouds, cool waters and pure streams flowing, enveloped by Indra's ladybugs, these rocky crags do please me so. The lovely ground, like the lofty peaks of looming clouds, like the most refined of palaces, the lovely calls of tuskers sound, these rocky crags do please me so. The lovely ground is rained upon, the hills are full of holy seers, resounding with the cry of peacocks, these rocky crags do please me so. Being clothed in flaxen flowers, as the sky is covered in clouds, strewn with flocks of various birds, these rocky crags do please me so. Not occupied by village folk, but visited by herds of deer, strewn with flocks of various birds, these rocky crags do please me so. With clear waters and broad boulders, holding troops of monkey and deer, covered with moist carpets of moss, these rocky crags do please me so. But there is not so much contentment for me in the fivefold music as in truly seeing Dhamma with a well-concentrated mind. That's the other theme that happens again and again in this poetry. I've extracted all the nature poetry I can find in the Pali Canon, and I'm putting it together and translating it as a group and hopefully publishing it someday. And what I've noticed again and again, when they allude to the beauty of nature with aesthetic appreciation, very often right afterwards they make some comment about how, and yet in the midst of that, they're not lost in it. They are maintaining their mindfulness. They are maintaining their concentration or whatever. The earth is sprinkled, the wind blows, lightning flashes in the sky. My thoughts are quieted, my mind is well concentrated. Despite all that going on, one holds oneself with dignity and composure. So in this case, the fivefold music is a poetic allusion to the desire, the pleasure coming through the five senses. So he's really delighting in that. He's being pleased by that in the foregoing stanzas, because he's pointing out the flowers and the sounds of the elephants and so forth, the sight of the animals frolicking. That's the information coming through the five strands, the five strands of the sense doors of sound and sight and so forth. Many of these poems also refer to the perfume of the flowers and so forth. So the allusion here is to the fivefold music, anything that comes in through the five senses. But he said, compared to that, holding yourself with a concentrated mind in the manner prescribed by the Dhamma, the teaching of the Buddha, is a pleasure even higher than that. A pleasure, of course, that he doesn't get lost in. And this is a common theme as well of the whole renunciate tradition, that whatever pleasure there you can get from the senses, you can get more pleasure by going beyond the senses into the well-composed meditative state. I guess I just want to say in closing, and I want to allow for one or two questions, that the lesson I take home from all this for us, myself, as householders who are living in a world really surrounded by, infused with sensory input, is to try as much as we can to experience pleasure with equanimity and experience pain with equanimity. Not everything that is uncomfortable, and I don't mean, you know, racking, terrible pains, but all those little ways in which we're not quite pleased by things and we get annoyed and so forth. If we can hold that with a little bit more equanimity, and the times when we find ourselves appreciating and feeling happy and so forth, that's okay. We don't have to beat ourselves up for that. But at the same time, we have to use whatever tools we're gaining from this practice of Vipassana, mindfulness, meditation, use that as a tool for examining as closely as we can and as honestly as we can whether we are experiencing that pleasure with a sense of equanimity or when, and it will definitely happen, when we are getting pulled into it, when we are dependent upon it. If you can't wait to, you know, have this special experience when you get home, you're going to jump in the hot tub or whatever, and you find out that the hot water heater is broken, can you be the same in the moment before that and the moment after that? Or whatever the experience. If you find yourself severely disappointed by something pleasurable that you were looking forward to, chances are that's an opportunity to notice an instance of that pleasure spilling over into desire, the wanting of the pleasure. So there are innumerable ways we can use this as a tool, as a practice in our everyday lives to try to understand better the dynamic of our mind and body as to how the pleasure leads to suffering. It's almost quarter of. Are there any questions? Thoughts? Yes. We certainly experience more, yes. I'm not sure, I don't entirely agree that we never lose preference. I think it's because the Buddhist models of mind is telling us that every moment is a new creation. We have habits of always looking and having preferences, but I think we can lose them. There's that wonderful poem in the later Mahayana tradition that starts with that phrase, I'm sure you all know it, the great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. And I think this is exactly the kind of thing they're speaking to. I think we find ourselves embedded in a network of likes and dislikes, wants and not wants. I think this teaching, the Buddha's teaching, is inviting us to step out of that from time to time, if only for a moment. The danger is we don't want to begin using mindfulness as a tool for maximizing pleasure. This isn't a yuppie practice. It's a yogi practice. It's not like if we're mindful of just the right this and just the right that, and we're kind of using it to drink as much pleasure as we possibly can out of something. That is a kind of what I think the Buddha would describe as an unskillful leaning into experience. And it's not that that's bad. It's that it's not a skillful strategy because it will always lead to disappointment. So I think we should find ways to have fewer preferences. Not on the big issues of, you know, social justice and environmental clarity and so forth, but in all the little ways. You know, if you're driving into the store and somebody swoops in and you know, steals your parking space, so what? Go find another one. You know, just little things like that, I think, are ways that we can learn to let go more and more of what we're so comfortable with as our set of preferences. I think in moments we can, yes. I think at the level of sort of larger construction of our ideas and our life and so forth, we probably don't. When we get on the cushion and drop down to the momentary unfolding of psychophysical phenomena in the mind and body, we can certainly have moments of no preference. We can't sustain that in the world of concepts that we our lives are largely built out of. We can't say, well, I don't really care what happens to me in my life. That's not realistic. Yes. Yes, yes. At that level at which we live our lives most of the time, preferences are built in pretty fundamentally. But I think what this practice is inviting us to taste is what it feels like to be free of that. If only for, you know, 7 minutes in the middle of a 40-minute set, you know, it does happen from time to time. And then once we begin to taste that, we can begin to bring that attitude a little bit more broadly into other aspects of our lives. And the Buddha is saying, it'll lead to a more compelling and more sustainable happiness if we're able to do that. Yes?
This is a very complex and very subtle question. I guess there's a phrase, like, don't sweat the small things. Is that sort of what you're saying? Or as opposed to this beautiful patch of ground that people are worried about, something that's going to be, it's not going to be plowed over. Something about this desire to maintain that. It is a desire. It's only a natural thing. Does one accept that with humility and just allow that to be?
I think as householders living in communities where we have certain responsibilities and duties around the integrity of that community, we can't help but need to take some interest in what happens to that patch of yard of land. I think the kind of freedom that the early Buddhists, and especially the monastic Buddhists, are pointing towards is one that is independent of that network of responsibilities. And one could see a beautiful patch of land get paved over. without it disturbing one's personal equilibrium. That doesn't mean that we should all stand by and see terrible things happen to our beautiful world. And, you know, as householders, it's our responsibility to protect that world. But in terms of, if we place our happiness entirely in dependence upon that patch of earth not being altered by any way, then we stand a good chance of being dissatisfied. And that experience around that patch of earth being the very cause of some great distress for us. And of course, you know, you take that thought experiment even farther, and you can have people fighting over that patch of earth. You know, I think it should be like this, and I think it should be like that. And before you know it, you have all kinds of conflict and turmoil and violence and so forth. So all the Buddha is pointing to, he's not trying to tell us, don't care about anything. He's telling us that if you look at the details of how the mind works, all of the trouble in the world and all of the trouble in our lives and all of the trouble in our communities has its roots in this very simple reflex of desiring things to be a certain way. And those desires come into conflict with one another and are the source of all the trouble. And so if we want to really drop out of that system altogether, there's a way of doing it, fully and completely. And that's the path he outlined. And if we want to live within that network of cause and effect as skillfully and as humanely and as compassionately as possible, then we can still use the knowledge gained about how this mechanism for strife occurs to help defuse situations wherever we see the opportunity to do so.
Yes. It just seemed like kind of an interesting question that was brought up at the very beginning when you said that we're kind of told to pursue happiness here. And I was thinking that the artist's job in some way is to pursue it and to capture it, to put it down in a way that it can be fairly accurately reproduced. The person reading the poem gets that experience. So it's led into a whole bunch of thoughts about thinking about the way that the artist's mind can capture and crystallize, but not get caught. I mean, the idea of the driven artist, not always being a very successful one, thinking about the difference between the Chinese idea of the gentleman artist who's not dependent on sales, is creating for pleasure or to share experience rather than to make a market and to...
Yes. On the issue of art, which is raised here, I mean, it is generally the case that in Asian artistic traditions, the creativity comes from getting the self out of the way and allowing things to sort of come up more spontaneously and intuitively, and then those creations then are clear of some of the entanglements of selfhood. Whereas in the West, there are at least some artistic traditions that really are built around and thrive upon the conflict of desires, of emotions, of the tensions and the resolution of those tensions, or sometimes the ratcheting up of those tensions. Two very different models.